Lecture 8, U.S. Civil War Spies in Blue and Gray.
On May 13, 1862, a strange covert operation was launched out of Charleston Harbor in South Carolina as the war between the states raged. A ship called Planter set sail with a crew made up entirely of African Americans, with an African American in command, Robert Smalls. Earlier that evening, the white crew members and the white captain had gone ashore to enjoy the delights of the town. Smalls had previously planned a bold escape attempt with his fellows, and now their moment had come. They were determined and desperate. The previous night, the Planter had been loaded with ammunition and guns, and the plotters had vowed that if they were stopped as they tried to escape, they would blow the ship to kingdom come with themselves as well. The Planter glided silently along and made its way to a nearby wharf, where some family members of the African-American crew were waiting. They came on board, and then the break for freedom began. Smalls, their leader, had been born in 1839 and had been hired out by his master in Charleston, where he had learned nautical skills. In fact, Smalls knew the paths around the Charleston Harbor and its defenses so well that he would have been awarded the title of pilot, except for the fact that he was a slave. Smalls even knew where the hidden mines were placed that blocked the harbor entrance, because he had helped to place them there. This evening, Smalls was in disguise. He was wearing the white captain's hat and jacket, and was even imitating his walk and mannerisms as the Planter slipped past the Confederate batteries. The Planter gave the correct signals to the batteries so they wouldn't fire, because Smalls had observed them. Then came the other dangerous stage of the escape. Once clear of the Confederates, nearing the Union blockade was going to be dangerous. Those were Union vessels primed to fire on Confederate ships. So Smalls shouted, "We surrender," and displayed a white flag, and the Union ships held their fire. What an amazing sight it must have been from the Union ships to see the Planter approaching. Smalls delivered the ship, and cargo valued at between $30,000 and $70,000 to the Union. The bravery of Smalls and his fellows gave valuable arguments to those in an ongoing debate about whether freed slaves should serve in the Union armed forces. Clearly, they had shown a heroic role here. Smalls served with the Union Navy during the war, and after the war entered politics, even becoming a U.S. congressman. As we saw with the American Revolutionary struggle, civil wars offer unique opportunities for mutual espionage as societies are torn apart. And this American war between the states showed the importance of institutions of espionage like the Pinkerton detectives, women spies like Belle Boyd, who became a legend, and the role of African Americans as agents. Yet the spying we'll discuss in this lecture did not develop neatly or in a linear evolutionary fashion from the exploits of the spymaster George Washington or the accumulated experience of the American Revolutionary struggle. In a phenomenon we'll see again in this course, a great many of the lessons of the earlier conflict had been forgotten in the peace that followed the gaining of independence and then the War of 1812. It was only with the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 1848 that organized intelligence gathering resumed. The American Army established so-called spy companies to work with American forces in Mexico. Not much is known about these companies. They were made up of Mexicans and Native Americans. In a way here, they were following the example we've already seen of the outsourcing of intelligence to others who will be less conspicuous in a foreign environment that the Mongols had already used in an ancient period. The spy companies may have done more guerrilla work, but apparently contributed a lot to General Winfield Scott's capture of Mexico City. But there was a fundamental fact to keep in mind as we begin our discussion of the American Civil War. There was no national intelligence network and no federal police. When the war did come, it would make new demands and present unprecedented challenges. What was at stake in general was the entire American experiment. The war would be one of tremendous ferocity, all the more bitter for being fought between brothers. This war indeed would take on aspects of what historians call total war, with the involvement of civilians as well as troops in the battlefield, with the home front and the battle front being both implicated. Now, usually, historians see World War I as the moment of the emergence of total war, but the American Civil War was in many ways a good portent of what was to come, what a modern industrialized war would look like, with the best and most scientifically advanced weaponry and dire impact on the civilian population. This impact ramped up through the course of the war, with the blockade of the South, the requisitioning of supplies in the war zones, and the fact that civilians were involved would become abundantly clear from November 1864 with General William Tecumseh Sherman's March to the Sea. When war first broke out, a secret spying war also commenced. The November 1860 election of Lincoln was followed by increased tension until the War of the Rebellion, to use its official U.S. name, broke out in earnest with a bombardment of Fort Sumter in April of 1861. At that signal, both sides scrambled to set up intelligence operations of their own, a difficult task. The North drew on Alan Pinkerton, a Scot who had established a Chicago private detective agency that already had won fame. Pinkerton warned the newly elected President Lincoln about an assassination plot that aimed to kill Lincoln on his way through Baltimore in February 1861 while he was traveling to his inauguration in Washington. Pinkerton claimed that he had found out about plotters who aimed to strike as Lincoln switched trains in Baltimore headed for D.C. Lincoln at first simply refused to change his plans. He wasn't going to give in to any sort of threat of this nature. But Pinkerton convinced him, after all, to take a different train and to ride with Pinkerton as his security escort. Now, in fact, there are some who doubt whether there really was much of a threat in Baltimore and surmise that perhaps Pinkerton had made himself indispensable with a phantom conspiracy of his own imagining that he then helped to foil. At any rate, Pinkerton had won some validity, some plausibility, and he was put in charge of the Union's espionage and counterintelligence. This is a good point to ask, who was Pinkerton? He had been born in Glasgow in Scotland in 1819, in pretty modest circumstances, and started out as an apprentice barrel maker. Pinkerton had gotten involved in politics, in the working-class Chartist movement that throughout Great Britain sought more rights for the working class. In 1842, however, Pinkerton got word that he was about to be arrested for his activism, and so Pinkerton fled. He took a ship across the Atlantic and escaped arrest. Now, how do you like this paradox? A great detective and later spy master starting out as a fugitive. It's probably not unreasonable to surmise that as he was a fugitive, he gained some valuable insights in how to track such people in the future. Once in the United States, Pinkerton became involved in law enforcement. And in 1847, he became deputy sheriff of Cook County, Illinois. That's the county in which my native city of Chicago is located. In 1850, Pinkerton moved to private enterprise by establishing a private detective agency, the Pinkerton National Detective Agency. It had an amazing motto and logo. The logo, which was one of the most awesome logos of all time, is an unblinking, wide-open eye. And the motto of the Pinkerton Detective Agency was, "The Eye That Never Sleeps." Hence, today, we still sometimes talk about detectives as private eyes, and this has its origin in Pinkerton's distinctive logo and marketing efforts. Pinkerton's staff grew, and among his employees was the first woman detective, Kate Warren. Pinkerton was hired in particular to work for the nation's railroads on security, and it was in this capacity that he had first approached Lincoln with that dire warning about the plot awaiting him as he was going to pass through Baltimore. Pinkerton's work on behalf of the Union, however, turned out actually to be quite a mixed record. And here there's an insight that bears some relevance to tradecraft. Pinkerton had been tremendously able as a detective undertaking civilian tasks. But the civilian work he had engaged in and had so much experience with did not always readily mesh with the requirements of military intelligence. Military intelligence required different kinds of facts, different kinds of information and interpretations placed on those facts than Pinkerton had in his store of experience. And so thus, Pinkerton, like many spy masters before him, including Sir Francis Walsingham in Elizabethan England, and like other spies on both sides of the Civil War, would have to learn on the job without extensive background in this profession of military intelligence himself. Pinkerton's inexperience with military reconnaissance also encouraged a peculiar dynamic, one which may very well have shifted the fortunes of the war considerably. Pinkerton had his own very personal, and apparently quite idiosyncratic, mathematical and allegedly scientific formulas for how to estimate the number of enemy troops in the field. He would, for instance, count up the number of reports that had come in from escaped slaves or from agents in the field, and would subject the numbers they provided to a statistical analysis. He would work them through the formulas. And the problem was that his personal formulas were set up in ways that sometimes yielded very high overestimates of how many Confederate troops were confronting the Union at a given campaign. Sometimes those overestimates ran to double the true number. And the dynamic that was set up then had its effect on General George McClellan, the Union commander. General George McClellan was already hesitant and hypercautious. He was famous for this. And when this false, overestimated information was passed to McClellan, it made him even more prone to avoid decisive action than he had been previously. Pinkerton's weaknesses in tradecraft also led to the loss of agents who were executed in the South. In particular, the case of a very talented spy, Timothy Webster. Pinkerton was very proud of him and would choose him for the most difficult and challenging tasks. Webster had tremendous abilities to quell suspicion and to move right into roles that he assumed as his cover. He was a master of passing himself off as a Southern sympathizer. He was, in fact, so good at passing himself off as a Southern partisan that he was actually arrested by another Pinkerton agent and had to be freed once it was made clear that this was actually a colleague of the arresting agent. Webster managed also to insinuate himself into the capital of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. And he was, in fact, even hired by the Confederate authorities to serve as a Southern agent. So he became a double agent by seeming to act for the South, but all the while passing information to the North about his assignments. And then tragedy struck. Webster was in Richmond, and he fell gravely ill. He was not able to communicate back with the North and to get word to Pinkerton of what had happened to him. Pinkerton was out of his mind with anxiety and worry on not having word from his most talented agent. And thus, he broke a rule of tradecraft. Instead of waiting for the agent to report in a methodical way that had already been previously set up, he improvised. Pinkerton sent two other agents down to Richmond to find out what had happened to his treasured agent Webster. The two Pinkerton agents went to Richmond. They were detected. They were arrested by Southern authorities. And one of them, in order to save his own life, gave up Webster's identity. Webster was hanged in April of 1862. Soon afterwards, McClellan was let go as commander of the Union forces, and Pinkerton himself lost his patron, as it were, and was sidelined and eventually returned to detective work, the kind of work that he had excelled at before and would again. The Confederacy, for its part, organized the Secret Service Bureau. The president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, had his government allocate $5 million to the tasks of Secret Service. Of that, $1 million was slated for special operations in Canada. Some of these plans really are ludicrous in their ambition and their improbability. One unlikely Confederate plan involved hijacking a warship, the USS Michigan, that was in Lake Erie, and using that ship to free rebel prisoners of war in two camps that were located on the coast, one near Sandusky, Ohio, and the other at Fort Douglas in Chicago. And then the liberated rebel prisoners of war would be taken on board the ship, and then they would become a fighting force in the rear of the North's lines. They could dominate the North with these forces. As it's hardly surprising that nothing came of this kind of plan. In another plan that was revealed in Canada, a Kentucky doctor named Luke Pryor Blackburn was charged with a nefarious and extremely sinister plot. He was charged with collecting clothing and bedclothes of yellow fever patients from Bermuda and secreting or collecting this clothing to use it to send to the northern states in order to start an epidemic on the sly. Another plan that became was exposed in November of 1864 aimed to take the war home to New York, to terrorize New York by the setting of fires in hotel rooms and also in P.T. Barnum's Museum of Curiosities. It's not entirely clear to me why P.T. Barnum's museum was targeted. Perhaps it was seen as a national treasure and its loss would be devastating. But nothing much came of this either. Cool heads prevailed, the fires were soon put out, and the conspirators were caught. The Civil War did turn out to be a seeming golden age for female spies. And we might ask, why should this be so? Now, clearly, as we've seen from the very start of our course, women have had a role in espionage. So this would not be the first time that women would be employed as spies. But now, for some reason, women spies became even more prominent. So we have to ask, what was new in this context? And the answer was something that had to do with the mood of the age. The answer lay with romanticism that we already had mentioned in our previous lecture. That 19th century artistic, literary, philosophical, as well as political movement that celebrated the heroic, the extreme, and longed for adventures that were out of the ordinary. In a word, romantic. The Scottish romantic writer Sir Walter Scott, in fact, has even been blamed for sparking the Civil War, because some have argued that Sir Walter Scott's historical romances set in the Middle Ages and his epics fired a quest for glory that did much to raise the temperature of national politics in America. Women were caught up in the romantic movement as well, and women spies could now, in a very romantic fashion, contribute to their country's cause by their own heroic efforts. And there was a further dimension here as well. The polite, genteel conventions of the day also meant that neither side in the American Civil War executed women spies. So this was a potent conjuncture. On the one hand, the chance for adventure, the chance for heroism, for romantic distinction, but on the other hand, also a certain measure of societal protection. Let's consider some famous cases. Elizabeth Van Loo, known popularly to her neighbors as Crazy Bet, was an abolitionist who lived in the South, in Richmond. And she was also a Northern sympathizer. This must have been quite an uneasy state of affairs for her, given the sympathies of her neighbors. She was unmarried and in her 40s. She came from a wealthy family, and she managed to disguise her activities by cultivating the image of being eccentric or mad. She was famous for walking the streets of Richmond, holding long, drawn-out arguments with herself, doing unpredictable things, and generally cultivating a reputation as being somebody who does not need to be taken seriously and does not need to be held accountable. But in fact, behind this cover of eccentricity or madness, she was doing serious work. In fact, she was running escape lines for Union soldiers who had been caught behind Confederate lines. She visited Union prisoners of war held in Confederate captivity and collected information from them about their experiences that might be of military utility. And in the ultimate coup, she managed to insinuate an ex-slave of her own family, the African-American woman Mary Elizabeth Bowser, into the very household of the Confederacy's president, Jefferson Davis. Bowser pretended to be illiterate, but actually was very well able to read documents that were left out on the open, left out on desks, and able, due to a photographic memory, able to recall their contents and information without needing to write it down. It's said that Bowser also served at table when General Lee and other commanders discussed military affairs with Davis. She was able to pass on crucial information. On the Confederate side, Rose Greenhow was a lively widow of 44 and a famed Washington, D.C. hostess, with many lovers and admirers, from Union officers to Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. She moved in exalted circles. She used her charms and favors to get information from them, which she then sent in ciphered messages south. Her contribution is judged to have been crucial for the first great engagement of the conflict, the First Battle of Bull Run, or Manassas, in July of 1861, because she'd been able to tip off General P.G.T. Beauregard's Confederate leadership that the Union troops were now moving forward. In the fighting of the Civil War, however, a Confederate command post had been captured, which contained documents that pointed to Greenhow as a spy. So she'd been exposed. The Union spymaster Pinkerton kept her house in Washington under watch to identify other spies who would be contacting her, and later searched her house. There, they found copies of reports she had written. This was a great mistake in tradecraft. Clearly, it was tremendously dangerous and irresponsible to have kept copies of secret information that would implicate her, and thus she was arrested on August 23, 1861. But astonishingly enough, even this did not deter her for long, because even under house arrest, she continued to smuggle out secret messages to the South. As the Union authorities lost patience, she was moved to be imprisoned in the old Capitol Prison, which is where the Supreme Court building stands today. In June 1862, she was sent south across enemy lines to Richmond. Now the Confederate government gave her a public relations mission. She was sent to Europe to gain allies for the South as a celebrity spy, I guess you would call her. Her memoir, which heightened the experiences she had had and presented herself in an even more heroic light, became a bestseller. And she was presented at royal courts and lectured to large audiences in Britain and France. She was to return to the South in triumph, but this turned to tragedy. On trying to return to America in a blockade runner ship, she was drowned off the coast of Wilmington, North Carolina, on her way back in 1864. According to the story, she drowned not because of the waves, but because she was weighed down by all the gold that she was carrying on another secret mission, or perhaps from her book royalties. And she was buried with full military honors in Wilmington. Another legendary figure was Belle Boyd, who was nicknamed the Siren of the Shenandoah, or the Siren of the South. This very young woman had been from the first a very open and fierce partisan of the South. She even wore a Confederate sash to announce to anyone who saw her her public sympathies. Talk about hiding in plain sight. When she was only 17 years old in Virginia, she had shot a Union soldier who was involved in an altercation of some sort with her mother in front of their house. One story suggests that the Union soldier had tried to take down the Confederate flag that was hanging there, that Belle Boyd had protested, had tangled with him, that he had tangled back, and then she shot him. Remarkably, however, she was judged to be too young to be charged for this event, and thus was allowed to go free. And she then went on to spy on Union officers who had been quartered in her mother's home. Boyd passed information to General Stonewall Jackson that may have turned the Battle of Front Royal. She was arrested after some of her messages were intercepted, but then, like Greenhow, she was exchanged to Richmond. Again like Greenhow, she was sent to Europe on a mission of public diplomacy and celebrity. On her return to America, she was intercepted and arrested. But then, and this is just characteristic of an eventful, dramatic life, she fell in love with and married the Union officer who had captured her. Later, she went on the stage and gave dramatic performances about her life as this noted celebrity Southern spy, and she finally died in Wisconsin in the year 1900. What a life. While figures like these spies were celebrated, a crucial role played by others was not recognized at the time. The role of African Americans in the secret war. Intelligence volunteered by slaves in the South, in a contribution to their own liberation that they made in a very active way, was called by Union officers black dispatches. According to one historical study, these black dispatches, or information passed by slaves, was the single most prolific and productive category of intelligence used by the Union forces in the war, far more so than those of celebrity spies. And what's intriguing is the social context of this information. In the South, the institution of slavery had conditioned a culture that views slaves as insignificant, not capable of the subtlety or intelligence required for spying or collection of information, and most of all, as passive rather than active. And thus, often, slaves were ignored, not noticed, where, in point of fact, great numbers of slaves could pass valuable tactical information to the Union forces as the battlefields moved south. And in fact, this kind of daring activity had a prehistory, that of the Underground Railroad. During the 1850s and 1860s, before the war, abolitionists had set up escape routes for slaves to make their way north. Harriet Tubman, called a Moses of her people, made many trips south in disguise and helped great numbers of slaves to escape. During the war, Tubman accompanied Union troops in the Carolinas and served as a valuable liaison with liberated slaves. But after the war was over, Tubman did not receive much recognition from the government. During the war, African Americans also spied behind Confederate lines, engaged in tremendously dangerous scouting for which they might have paid with their lives if captured. Pinkerton was especially proud of one of his African American agents, John Scoble, who observed behind the Confederate lines. He had been a slave in Mississippi, but had been freed by his master, who also, unusually, had given him an education. Scoble was a master of disguise. He could play the roles of cook or manual laborer, all the while carefully counting Confederate troop strength, the position of particular units, and the movement of Confederate forces. To take another example, in Norfolk, Virginia, Mary Tuvestre, a free woman of color, was employed in the house of a Confederate engineer working on the Southern ironclad ship, the Merrimack. She stole the plans for the ship and escaped to the north, passing the documents to the Union command. These agents, not professionals, but amateurs motivated by the impulse towards self-liberation, played a role that after the war was not fully appreciated, but is being appreciated in our own times. This American Civil War had also revealed something else: the impact technology could have on modern warfare. The importance of railroads was key, for instance, in the overall war. The use of telegraph also changed the pace of the war, providing communication at speeds that would have been unthinkable before. And this, in turn, opened up a new possibility, that of real-time intelligence that could be acted on with a minimum of time between report and reaction. This was the advent of a new stage in SIGINT, or signals intelligence, and from this point, SIGINT will take on more and more importance. In one example, the Northern spy, J.O. Kirby, found a position as a railroad official in the South and tapped telegraph lines at Richmond, sending information on to D.C. The wartime intrigues we've discussed did have a disastrous finale after the conflict was officially over with the surrender of the South in April of 1865. During the war, Confederate agents in Canada had been visited by John Wilkes Booth in Montreal and discussed a plan to kidnap Lincoln. With the end of the war, this changed into a plan for a revenge killing, which took place when Booth shot Lincoln at Ford's Theater on April 14, 1865. In this lecture, we saw the full vicious competitive struggle to build up espionage during the Civil War. The same sort of competition was also accelerating on a world scale as global imperialism roared ahead, as we'll see in our next lecture.